The following podcast contains strong language and adult themes and is intended for mature audiences. Listener discretion is advised. Hanky Digital presents The Skin. Show me what lies beneath. An audiobook podcast by Christian Heinke. Chapter 7. About. Sweat oozed from the pores of her new skin. That's my sweat, my skin. That's me, she thought. She still couldn't believe it. She had died after all. And yet I'm here, she whispered. The statement filled the room, consumed by the sultriness. Catherine sighed, stood up, and stepped out of the heat of the sauna. The previous owner had a sauna built on the upper floor of the boathouse. A narrow staircase descended to a landing, then another to the spacious dock, smelling of wood and the sea. The dock was empty. Richard's dream was to own a small boat and teach Danny and her how to sail. But his death shattered all these dreams. Naked as she was, she jumped into the cold water. For a moment, it took her breath away. She glided underwater for a few strokes, and then reappeared in the open air. The morning mist slowly receded. The water was smooth and calm. She turned onto her back and let herself drift. The cold of the water enveloped her with angry stabs. She let the pain get to her, absorbed it, enjoyed it to the full. She lifted one arm and looked again at the shell that surrounded him immaculately. This is me, she thought again. This is my skin. Out here, in the water, alone with the pain, it sounded less like a lie. Kathy! A voice suddenly called out. Startled, Catherine paused. She turned her head toward the call and recognized her father. He was standing at the threshold of the footbridge that led to the boathouse. She waved, which he mistakenly interpreted as an invitation to come closer. Full of energy, he strutted across the wooden planks. My dad, she thought, an aging peacock. Catherine swam to the gangplank, got out of the water, swiftly wrapped herself in her bathrobe and ran to meet him. She didn't want him here. The boathouse was a beautiful, peaceful place. It reminded her a little of her birthplace in Virginia. She had been happy there until her parents divorced. No, until her father divorced and remarried. Her new mother and Catherine hated each other by mutual consent. Then a fashion agent approached Catherine in a cafe on Virginia Beach. The woman inquired about her interest in modeling. Catherine was 12. Why not? She replied. She wanted to get away from home. Away from him. That was the beginning of her journey with pain. After it ended, and after the miracle of giving birth to a healthy child, Richard and she had discovered this property. When the estate agent showed them to the boathouse, Catherine immediately knew that she had finally found an actual home again. No, she didn't want her father here. Nowhere in the boathouse, estate, St. Michael's, or here. She's amid her second life. Even if she owed this second life to him. They stood opposite each other. Catherine pulled her robe tighter around her and wrung out her hair. Her father beamed at her. You look beautiful, princess. She managed to smile faintly. You too, Dad. He reached his cheek towards her, expecting the usual kiss. Instead, she gave his hand a quick squeeze. He looked at her, confused. "What is it?" he asked. "What are you doing here?" she asked back, shaking her hair. A few splashes landed on the tips of her father's shoes, and he took a step back. That expression on his face said it all. "Where is my good, obedient little girl?" "I could tell you, Daddy-o," she thought with a frown. "But you wouldn't like the answer." "No, not at all. Too much sex, too many drugs." Her father's gaze fell on her bathrobe. "Are you not concerned about the paparazzi when you go swimming like that?" Catherine shrugged her shoulders. "Like Vivian always says, paparazzi are like terrorists. If you give in to them, they win." "Said." Her father corrected her. "What do you mean?" Catherine looked at him in disgust. "Are you saying you haven't heard?"
"Heard what?"
Her father looked out at the water and fell silent.
"Heard what?"
Catherine asked again, this time almost shouting. Her father reported, in brief, concise sentences, impassive. Catherine listened to him in silence. When he finished, she turned away and went into the house. He followed her. As if in a dream, she brewed the tea and handed him a cup. He blew, drank, and grimaced. "You make tea just as well as your mother," he lied. She stared out of the kitchen window at the boathouse.
"Let's not talk about Mum," she said.
"What do you want to talk about?"
"About Vivian, perhaps?"
"No," she sobbed blankly. "Dad, please." He gave her a scrutinizing look and fell silent. The silence that descended upon the room reminded her that this house would be silent forever. No more murmuring from Richard's office, no more screeching from Danny, who was romping around, outside with his friends, no more eager calls from Vivian.
"I want you in Washington with me,"
her father said abruptly, disrupting the silence and her thoughts. Despite her gratitude, she sighed and asked her dad, "What am I supposed to do? I live here now." He put the cup down on the coffee table. She noticed he had only sipped the tea.
"What life do you think it is?"
"My life, Dad." Her answer didn't seem to convince him. "I'm worried, Catherine. Can't you understand that?" No, she couldn't imagine him worrying about her. He hadn't done it before, and he wouldn't do it now. He had long since gotten used to doing things the way he did them. To change the subject, she casually brought up, "I bumped into Andy recently."
"Andy? The Andy? Andy Peterson?"
"That's the one, Dad."
The senator chuckled quietly.
"I see, so that's it." The mockery in his voice made her angry.
"No, Dad. That's not it. Please listen to me, child. You're not safe here."
Now his voice took on that familiar, authoritative tone that brooked no argument. However, she refused to give in.
"I have enough people here to protect me. Henry the groom, the two gardeners, and Andy."
She wanted to add his name, but he was right on this one point, and she hated it when her father was right. Although she no longer believed she would ever win Andy back, she stayed at St. Michael's because of him. "What's the point of being here? If I know he won't come back?" she asked herself. "Why don't I go to Washington with Daddy-o?"
No, she was in charge of her own life, not her father. That was already a reason that was enough.
"The point is, Dad, I don't want to join you in Washington."
At last, it was finally out. To her surprise, he accepted her words calmly.
"I can understand that."
He cleared his throat.
"I can understand that all too well. I was never a good husband to your mother. Not a good father to you either. Still, I'm asking you to trust me anyway and come to Washington."
"And why?" she asked.
"For God's sake, Kathy, I can protect you in Washington."
What are you trying to protect me from, Dad? That madman? What makes you think I'd be safer from him in Washington than here? He didn't answer. He opened his mouth, but then said nothing. Instead, he stood up, picked up his coat from the coat rack, and walked to the door. You're just as stubborn as your mother, he remarked dryly. It sounded sad and resigned, and somehow more genuine than all the countless empty phrases he usually used. Dad, she began, and followed him to the door. Dad, I just want to... It's all right, Catherine. You're right. You have your own life. That's what you've always done. Dad, please. Take care of yourself, he said. She paused at the doorway, watching him. The chauffeur opened the car door. She wondered about his intentions. Dad, what was it you wanted to tell me? It must have been important, otherwise you wouldn't have wasted so much of your precious time on your stubborn daughter. Without answering her, Senator Williams roared off in his car. That's just how the news business is. I don't know why you're making such a fuss here, Miss Louisiani. Douglas Melvin did not miss the opportunity to grin with his frog mouth. Any new person in your life, by chance? Apart from your cat, of course. He grinned even wider. Helen struggled to resist drawing her gun and using it against the abomination in the interrogation room. He's not worth it, she thought, and instead just replied, Detective. Detective Louisiani. Huh? Doug looked at her questioningly. You address me as a detective.
Oh.
And only now did he seem to understand.
All right, detective.
Now you've got it. Helen smiled icily. Doug pointed to her bandaged right hand with an exaggerated nod of his head. How did this happen, detective? Maybe in a run-in with the killer? Helen managed not to make a face. Doug smiled. Of course. He lowered his eyes and folded his hands as if in prayer. Somehow I have the feeling I've struck a nerve with you. I mean, after all, you're one of the few surviving police officers from 9/11. Unlike others, you never tried to profit from that traumatic incident. Why not? He continued. Is it perhaps because you had an affair with your married colleague? I mean, Ricardo Mendez's widow expressed this suspicion to me. Share your side of the story for my readers. He didn't finish the sentence. With a quick movement, Helen slapped the first of the letters wrapped in clear plastic bags on the table, silencing him. Inez Diega and Peter Moore, she hissed, tapping the letter with her index finger. Detective, Mia Wong and Victor Adams. The second letter. Anuradha Appala. The third letter landed on the table. Doug licked his lips uneasily. And last but not least, Lauren Gramney and Vivian Lemoire, five women and two men, all brutally murdered. And now, thanks to your tabloid, we know. Helen slammed the Inquisitor edition on the table. The headline burst out of the paper. Catwalk Killer Kills Again. Exclusive. The Beast's Secret Message. You deliberately withheld information in order to sell a few more copies, seriously hindering our investigation. Before I book you for this, I'd like to hear your side of the story, Mr. Melvin. Have you ever heard of freedom of the press? He tried to defend himself. Helen leaned forward, her jaw grinding. Finally, she blurted out, I don't give a damn about your freedom of the press. Wow, detective, may I quote you? A voice she didn't recognize sounded from the door. Helen wheeled around. A slim man, dressed in an expensive suit, entered with a briefcase. Harlan Jackson. I don't think I'd better shake your hand, he said, pointing to Helen's bandage. So, I'll get straight to the point. I'm from the National Inquisitor's Legal Department, and I represent the interests of Mr. Melvin. The show you're putting on here is over now, Detective Louisiani. My client will answer no more questions. Of course, Helen murmured, smiling painfully. She was sweating and shaking with anger. Douglas Melvin rose and grinned at her with relish. Maybe you'll reconsider about the 9/11 story. As you know, I'm always interested in a good story. He shouldered his jacket and sauntered after the lawyer. Helen sat still, then fiercely swept the table clean.
Katso!
She shrieked. She was on the verge of crying. Uh-oh, you're swearing in Italian. That bad? Asked Davis, who had just entered the room. Helen nodded. Even worse. Now Davis couldn't help grinning.
I think I can cheer you up.
He pulled out a bow from behind his back. Hit on the DNA of the perpetrator? Asked Helen. He nodded. Someone we know? He nodded again. Who is it? Davis silently placed the sheet on the table. Helen looked at him in amazement. But it's not from our database. Exactly. This one comes from the OPTN database. The OPTN database recorded all organ donations and transplants in the country. Helen read the name on the document and then looked at Davis in amazement. That's not possible. Davis shrugged his shoulders. DNA doesn't lie. Helen stared at the sheet again. Then she let out another hearty curse in Italian. Less than half an hour later, she was sitting at her desk on the phone with Decker, the forensic scientist in charge. All right, then. Explain it to me again. She massaged her temple with her free hand.
There's nothing to explain, Detective. The crime scene's DNA matches the OPTN database. No doubt about it.
Okay, Helen muttered. Naturally, it was unacceptable since the entire thing lacked logic. What can you tell me about these deep abdominal wounds? She asked.
Well, they're unusual.
In what way? They had to report to Chief Phillips about the investigation's progress, so her mood was not the best. But the coroner didn't seem to have noticed the disgruntlement in her voice.
Usually, a serial offender doesn't change his approach,
he explained.
But in this case, the torso cuts were different. And that's unique. This Limoir's cut was V-shaped. The other woman's was L-shaped. I'm sure you noticed that, too. That is unusual.
Limoir V-shaped, Gramney L-shaped, Helen scribbled in the notepad, and before she had written the last letter, she paused. Vivian Limoir, Lauren Gramney. V for Vivian, L for Lauren. Wait a minute.
Hello? Are you still there?
On the other end of the line, Decker inquired. Yes, yes, of course. Helen regained her composure. She frantically dug out the files. The cuts on the other victims are also different, aren't they?
As far as I remember, yes. You should already have the reports.
I'm just checking. She nervously leafed through the files. Diega. Vertical cut. Wong. Zigzag cut. So was the letters I and M. You meant an M with a zigzag cut, didn't you?
Yes, absolutely. The cut really looked like an M.
Decker interrupted himself briefly.
Are you implying what I think, Detective?
I don't know yet. Helen hesitated. Maybe. Is the report from Brooklyn in yet?
You mean the Indian girl?
Yes.
I have it here.
I saw the body when I was there. The stomach wound? Would you say it resembles an A? Asked Helen. Decker thought about it. He began slowly.
The cut did indeed form an A. Do you think the perpetrator carves initials into his victims like a boy in love carves the bark of a tree?
Seems so, Helen said, staring at the photos. Thank you, Decker. Chief Phillips was on the phone when Helen and Davis entered her office. I understand, Miss Risk. No. It's not in the interests of our department, either. She looked up and motioned for them to sit down. Yes, they're here right now, I assure you, Miss Risk. Good. All right, I'll be in touch. Helen had never met her mother, which, in her father's opinion, was not a tragedy. She wished her mother could have been like Chief P. Phillips was the gentlest and most sociable person Helen had ever met. Phillips's angry reaction particularly surprised her, slamming the phone down after the call. Old John Risk was bad enough, but his bitchy little daughter is even worse. She noticed Helen's surprised look. Sorry, Helen. You know what I mean. She waved her off. If Phillips used strong language, there was a good reason for it. No problem. I've already heard about Miss Risk. What did the prosecutor want from you? Phillips leaned back and sighed. Your head. Oh, was all Helen could think of. She thought about what could have turned the prosecutor against her. She couldn't think of anything. Unless... Shit, not because of that Doug Melvin, is it? Phillips nodded gravely. That's right. The inquisitor's lawyer is giving the prosecution hell about it. Besides, the mayor is breathing down my neck about solving the murders. Two model agencies have already threatened to move out of town if the catwalk killer isn't caught by the end of the month. Shit. You could say that. I know from my experience that each case has its own unique dynamic, but I need results as soon as possible. Otherwise, I won't be able to do anything for you, Helen, and I'll have to hand the case over to someone else. So what have you got? Helen and Davis exchanged glances before turning to Phillips. Apparently, the perpetrator marks his victims. The abdominal incision is in the shape of the first letter of their first name. He cuts their stomachs open in the shape of an initial? Asked Phillips. Do we know why? No, we don't know. Is that all? What else have you got? They both began together, with Helen saying nothing, and Davis concluding with something. Phillips looked at her in amazement. Kids, what now? We've got a lead, Davis said, although Helen's gaze signaled him to keep quiet. Don't keep me in suspense. What kind of lead? Davis put the sheet with the DNA analysis on the table. Phillips took her unloved glasses out of a desk drawer and read it through. Then she looked at them over the rims of the lenses. Solid evidence, she said, then added, Helen, you're the only National Academy graduate here. Chief P was alluding to the BSU's National Academy, the FBI's Behavioral Science Unit. There, selected investigators learned the basics of profiling serial crimes. Helen accomplished the academy 3 years ago. She knew why Phil had recommended her for the program. 2 years later, she still suffered from the traumatic events of 9/11. Her attendance at the academy was supposed to be occupational therapy. It also meant she wasn't a burden to her colleagues here in the department. Helen used her ordered time off to imprison multiple serial offenders. This not only earned her Chief Phillips's respect, but also that of some higher-ups in the department. So, Helen, what's bothering you? Phillips interrupted her thoughts. Everything. The profile doesn't fit. How do you know that? Davis roared. I know it. I fought with the perpetrator. This, she pointed to the paper, is a mistake. A mistake? Why? She'd never seen Davis like this before. She didn't want to argue with him, especially not in front of Phillips. I just know it, Davis, she said. Phillips shook her head, and Helen knew she had lost. I'm sorry, Helen. I put a lot of stock in your hunches, your gut feeling. But with such a strong evidence, I have no choice. If the Risk gets wind that we're holding this back, it won't just be my head rolling. She noticed Helen's dejection and added, If you were me, you'd have to do the same, Helen. Yes, of course, Chief. Davis touched her arm, but she pushed him away. Where are you going? He asked her. To the motor pool. Don't you think we need to arrest someone? Then she stormed out of the office. Davis sighed. Philip smiled timidly and shook her head again. Never screw around with an Italian woman. She'll get over it, Davis said, more to himself than to the chief. If you say so. If I were you, I'd hurry, though, or she'll leave without you. Shit! Davis shouted, jumping up and running after her. She almost left without Davis. As they drove south, Helen didn't say a word. They took a quick break, and Davis took the wheel. Sitting in the passenger seat, Helen observed the city growing distant as it disappeared from view. Davis opened the window a crack and took a theatrical deep breath. Ah, country air. Lovely, isn't it? Go to hell, whispered Helen, continuing to stare out of the window. Well, at least you're swearing again. That's actual progress, grumbled Davis. They drove on in silence for a while, letting themselves drift with the flow of traffic. Time wasted, Helen muttered, lighting a cigarette. Davis kept one hand on the wheel and swiftly lit her cigarette. The gesture calmed things down, making Davis think it best to stay silent and avoid ruining the fragile peace once more. Helen blew out smoke. We're looking for a very organized perpetrator, she said. What makes you think that? The letters. He plans every murder well in advance. He's estimated to be between 25 and 35 years old. He studied. Maybe psychology. Maybe humanities. He's self-centered, can ruthlessly manipulate people, but has a very engaging personality. If he were a salesman, he could sell ice to Eskimos. Imagine that. He gets his victims to do most of the mutilating themselves. She flicked the butt out of the car window. That's illegal, grumbled Davis. Helen ignored him. He comes from a humble background, she continued. His father, or an uncle, or some other important person practiced the butcher's trade. She paused and brushed a strand of hair behind her ear. Something happened to him, probably in his childhood. Some traumatic event that made him conspicuous. Maybe he had experienced imprisonment before? Yes. That would be one approach. But then something else happened. An accident, perhaps. Davis said. What do you mean by hum? Helen asked, looking at him. A bit many maybes, if you ask me. I am right, said Helen. This is a waste of time. Davis fell silent. It rained, and he switched on the windshield wipers. The sound made Helen sleepy. She was tired of always being the party crasher. She was so tired. Her eyes fell shut. If you... Davis began. Oh, sorry. It's okay, she mumbled. What did you want to say? Davis hesitated, then replied, If you're right, we'll find out. Helen closed her eyes again. Have you informed Interpol about Ella Henson? She asked. All taken care of. She's still in Milan? Yep. They fell silent again. Eyes still closed, Helen remarked. It's not about being right. You believe me, don't you? Yeah, sure, Davis replied unconvincingly. Helen punched him in the arm. Ow! He shouted. Didn't you want to get some sleep? I do, she said, and grinned. I'm just moving around. Ah, so, he replied and laughed. So everything was finally good between them again. Thank you for listening. To learn more about Heinke Digital audiobook podcasts and its author, Christian Heinke, please visit heinke.digital.